Hello and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And what about this one? What about the advice we sometimes get that we should preach the gospel always, but when necessary, use words? I know you've heard it because people say it all the time. And as much as there might be some truth in the fact that our lives should constantly be sharing the gospel with others, even when we're not speaking, we should be demonstrating the gospel. Is it really true? Is that an effective strategy as far as sharing the faith goes, especially given the conditions of the world today? Is it enough just to preach the gospel with our lives? And then only on those occasions when it's necessary to use words. We've got a wonderful guest here to help us kind of evaluate that. He's gone through a kind of a conversion in his own life about whether or not that's an effective strategy. Dr. Tommy Hine is our guest. He's an attending physician at Massachusetts General Hospital and instructor in medicine at Harvard Medical School. Like his wife, Dr. Nancy, he's a double board certified in internal medicine and pediatric and works primarily as an adult hospitalist, which I think if you don't know what that is, Dr. Gregory House, I think that's basically what it is. I'm going to ask him, but I think that's what it is. He cares for patients admitted to the hospital. Before his medical training, he completed a master's in early church history from the University of Oxford. He's done multiple mission trips visiting more than 15 countries around the world. He's passionate about pro-life causes and Catholic apologetics, and he's completing his formation as a permanent deacon with a planned ordination date in the fall. I know that's kind of a come down. You know, it's Harvard, it's Oxford. We're usually trying to operate at a higher level here, but we'll settle for it. Dr. Tommy Hine, thank you for being here with us.
Thank you so much.
Is that what you do? Are you a Dr. Gregory House type character?
That's funny. It's the first time I've heard that as a comparison, but for the layman, that's probably the closest. I mean, House is, infamously not very medically accurate because they do everything, you know, they need to do a brain biopsy and they do the neurosurgery, et cetera. But the overall idea that, yeah, there's six patients in the hospitals and we try to be a combination of Sherlock Holmes and Mother Teresa, providing both, you know, good science to figure out what's going on and compassionate care to help them in a time of trial. So yeah, the hospitalist is similar to what Gregory House does, yeah.
Very nice, except that you don't make as many mistakes. Except it's a one-hour show. They've got to make those mistakes. You don't get points for making mistakes in the actual hospital. By the way, we want to make a quick disclaimer that you're not speaking on behalf of Harvard or Mass General or anybody else. These are your own ideas today.
Exactly. Usual disclaimer. I'm not speaking for my employer or my academic institutions. Thanks.
Okay. So if I could, you studied church history first. Maybe you could give us just a little bit of your bio and then we can talk about this when necessary use words idea, which let me just give a spoiler. You say it's not a good idea. It's a terrible idea, as a matter of fact. So how'd you come to that conclusion? What's the story of how you came to that conclusion?
Well, first of all, just thanks so much for having me and just God bless you guys for the good work you guys do on this podcast and otherwise in Catholic Answers. But yeah, I'll be honest. It took me, the better part of my life to kind of realize that just how terrible that strategy is. Basically, sort of be a good example, be a loving person, be a nice guy, and then hope that basically everywhere around you, people will, you know, start turning to the faith and receiving the Eucharist, for example. So just to give some background, you know, I grew up a wonderful Catholic family, number six of eight kids. My dad's a pediatrician, grew up in a very warm Catholic household, daily mass, all the sort of wonderful things. As a testament to my parents and just the great education that they give, we'll talk about that later, is an important sort of retention strategy that we're not doing very well as a church. But, you know, we went to very good Catholic schools. And as a testament to that, two of my sisters, one is a consecrated virgin, the other is a religious nun. So, you know, and everyone's still in the faith, which is rare these days, of all my siblings and now all the grandkids. So a very Catholic upbringing. But but you kind of the intimation all the way along was this, well, you know, preach always when necessary, use words. And it was attributed to St. Francis of Assisi, who we all love. Of course, he's not the one who said that. He's the one who preached to the Sultan and birds and everybody else who would listen. But, you know, that was kind of the milieu that I think many of us grew up in, that, you know, basically we're not going to, you know, we're not evangelicals. We're not going to knock on doors. So that's kind of how I grew up, including I went to a high school at a school run by Cistercian monks, wonderful, very learned men who, you know, I learned theology very, very well. But I recall as I was sort of transitioning from high school to college, there was a Christian-Muslim debate. This is just an example of the sort of preaching strategy that we're not doing very well. And one of my most revered mentors, who, you know, speaks all these different languages and has written all these sorts of books, was paired against the local imam. And I just recall that basically the Cistercian monk, when the imam started bringing up sort of attacks, it was supposed to be an ecumenical debate, you know, Christianity and Islam, so forth, sort of ecumenical dialogue, rather. The imam kind of went more on the attack and said, well, you know, we've got these proofs that Christ wasn't truly divine and blah, blah, blah. And the Cistercian monk sort of, tried to rise above and refused to engage a little bit, said, well, you know, like, we're trying to do ecumenism here. Those objections have been dealt with. But I will say, as a young man, even with all the upbringing I had and the tuition for Catholic schools my parents had paid for, that I walked out of there and I was handed, there's a big table with the Muslim volunteers from the local mosque handing out, you know, basically why you should be Muslim and parts of the Quran and so forth. And I thought, and I will say for years, I thought afterwards about becoming Muslim because of sort of the materials I received from them. Okay, so that's just one little snapshot. But otherwise, I went to my undergrad. It was University of Dallas, a wonderful liberal arts school. I was surrounded by good Catholics and so forth. I wasn't sure what to do with my life. I went and did this master's in early church history from Oxford. And while there was sort of this culture shock, and that all of a sudden I was in a very, very small minority, not just as a Catholic, not just as a Christian, but just sort of in general as a religious person. You know, there were in my sort of, I lived in a house with seven other people from many different countries, and, you know, none of them were Christian or really people of faith. And, you know, just like an example, two of them from China, very intelligent, coming to get a master's in economics or something from Oxford, they weren't sure that Christ had existed. They just knew, you know, from the Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown. They said, did he really exist? So I thought, well, here's my moment. I'm going to preach always when necessary, use words. So I tried to be this loving example in our house. And, you know, people knew that I was studying theology and so forth. It was just novel to them. I said, you're studying neurology? I said, no, theology. Oh, are you religious? You know, so basically, fast forward a year towards the end of my master's program, but nobody's become Christian. Nobody becomes Catholic around me. And I can't really say that, you know, maybe they know a little bit more about the faith, perhaps if a conversation came up once or twice or so forth. But in fact, one of my, the Chinese housemates I mentioned about, you know, who only knew the Da Vinci Code Jesus, well, I had learned towards the end of my master's that Jehovah's Witnesses had come a couple months before and knocked on the door. And sure enough, she was becoming a Jehovah's Witness and, you know, kind of being accepted in their church and so forth. And I thought, here I'm living with this person, having meals with this person. And I've sort of like failed, whereas some, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses who hardly know them have done much better. Continue to fast forward. I taught in a seminary in Spain for a year and so forth. So I thought, okay, well, I need to be a little bit more active. So in medical school, we started a Catholic sort of medical student group. We had different talks on campus about stuff like God and psychiatry, or, you know, the soul and science, stuff like this. And we had people come, including from other faiths. But again, I can say by the end of medical school, I don't know that, you know, again, just sort of trying to be a good example and even trying to have talks and encourage people to come to talks, I can't say it was quite working, you know, as far as, you know, people who previously, you know, were not practicing now becoming more practicing and so forth. And it was, again, another little snippet, a sort of revelation, is that spending time with some Baptist evangelical physicians, because they had a pretty active ministry on that campus. And for example, hearing one strategy that, you know, many Catholics are hearing, and say, oh, that just sounds crazy. But so they told two older evangelical doctors, what they would do is they'd, whenever they fly somewhere for a medical mission or whatever, one would sit in the airplane in the aisle and the other would sit in the window seat. So there'd be sort of kind of seats A and C, and someone sitting in seat B would be the poor unlucky soul or lucky soul who basically would get evangelized to. You know, essentially one would sort of talk about, well, what are you doing with your life? What happens next? What's happening next? And at the end, well, then what happens after you die? And they say, well, I don't know. And they say, well, this guy in seat C, he's going to tell you. And they'd evangelize. And it's this really high sort of quote success rate of people accepting Jesus as a personal Lord and Savior, which again, I think the average Catholic would kind of say, oh, that sounds very superficial and, you know, phony and whatever. And that's not a real relationship. But, you know, certainly got me thinking that, well, here, and I looked at my own life, my own wonderful parents who've been working in medicine for decades and decades and preach always when necessary use words. And again, I don't, the Lord knows how souls are moved, but that, you know, just seeing what seems to be effective and what not so much. I think finally the revelation came to me in, well, basically during the pandemic, everything was locked down. We were still working, but I was working, you know, in a different way, and many other responsibilities kind of disappeared. And we weren't obviously able to go to Mass. So it was honestly listening to Bishop Barron, first his homilies, you know, because sort of shopping around, those were some of the best homilies on the internet. And then really diving into more of his podcasts and Word on Fire, that for me, the pieces kind of connected that, you know, and we can talk about this a little bit more, but, you know, basically the huge, huge problem, it wasn't just me in Oxford. It's not just what I see, sort of around here, as far as the huge number of Catholics who have left the faith or are no longer practicing their faith. And the sort of lack of reverse flow of people coming back or coming, sort of in the first place, and sort of reasons for it and so forth. So it was really, I think, Bishop Barron and that sort of revelation in the last few years that kind of made me rethink my own sort of life strategy, which I'd sort of inherited from, you know, I think very well-intentioned parents and religious educators growing up, that made me realize, okay, preach always when necessary, use words, where I think words are basically necessary. And all these other religious groups I kind of encountered, including on lots of medical mission trips, just have better stats and they're doing, seem to be have more success.
That's I think that you articulated extremely well, but I don't think that that is an insight unique to you in this sense. It does seem that in the last 15, 20 years, Catholics are looking around going, what happened? There's a kind of devastation of Christianity, certainly, but among Catholics, where young people who maybe in the past the family structure that they had would have been sufficient to retain them in the faith no longer retains them, and we're losing people at a really kind of shocking rate, and we're not bringing people in. There isn't a sense of vitality that people are coming in.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And of course, I'm not, I mean, you guys are living this, breathing this, and this is, you're preaching it. So thank you so much for what you do. You know, I can think of other groups of Word on Fire, Focus Missionaries, yeah, and so forth, that are really, you know, kind of re-realizing, you know what, maybe in the first few centuries of the church, it was sufficient, you know, Tertullian says, you know, look how they love each other. So the idea is, you know, Christians weren't doing infanticide and they were taking care of the sick. And that was a really beautiful thing. Well, fast forward to today, and, you know, basically, the West is sort of ingested, digested, and now lives, you know, basically to some degree, Christian agape, the vulnerable are being taken care of and so forth. So, you know, being a nice doctor, I mean, most of my colleagues are nice doctors. They care about the sick and they're right, compassionate and so forth. So yes, it's clearly, and then I'd say on the flip side of that is that, you know, just the onslaught, whether that's made accelerated because of the internet and TikTok and all these things, but just of a counter-Christian, a counter-Catholic message in a very vehement one, you know, obviously a new atheist, but, you know, whatever it might be, then every Hollywood, it seems like almost any Hollywood movie that has a nun or a priest in it, it's a very negative portrayal. So you have kind of you know, on the one hand, what used to make Christianity very attractive is in many ways no longer unique to it. And on the other, you have all these sort of contra, you know, Christian, you know, messages that are out there, that, you know, I think just for the average young person going to college, it's like, well, why? I mean, the church is, everyone's telling me it's homophobic and it's, you know, it suppresses women. It does these terrible things. I mean, you know, God, well, if he's out there, well, knows I'm a nice person, that's probably enough. So I'm probably okay. So, I mean, it's very, it's funny. I went to mass a few months ago and a bishop who will not be named, not my bishop, but basically said, you know, kind of mentioned some of the stats, which are, you know, just so shocking. And sort of mentioned after it, you know, and it's kind of a mystery. Kind of a mystery why this is. And I just like put my head down in the pew and said, it's not a mystery. You know, I didn't say that. I thought, you know, Your Excellency. And even if it were, then look, the church and science have gone well together for millennia. Let's do some surveys. Let's get our social science people, our epidemiology people, and figure out why they're leaving, what we can do about it. So
this is one of the things I like about your approach. And I'd like you to kind of take you through it, if I could, that you apply your medical training to this problem.
Yeah.
So go ahead. Yeah, please.
Please. Yeah. And again, with the caveat that I'm not an expert, you know, you guys are the experts, but I will say, and then the other caveat being, you know, I love the quotation from Pastor, who is it? D.T. Niles, who says that evangelism is just a poor man who's found bread trying to share bread with someone else. So that's what we're doing here. You know, we've found something that we think will really transform someone's life. And of course, we want to share the good news, because goodness gracious, people are out there very loudly proclaiming everything about their political views, sports views, views on humanitarian crises, college kids getting arrested left and right. So people have the guts to do that. Certainly we can try to have the guts to preach for, you know, eternity. But yeah, so I think maybe I was inspired by, you know, Bishop Barron, and I'm not sure if he's the one who coined it, but sort of the idea that we're hemorrhaging Catholics, where the church is hemorrhaging its members. And so using that sort of modality of, okay, I'm a physician, I take care of hemorrhaging patients, not infrequently. Well, anytime there's a problem, well, in medicine, what you do is first you kind of get the vital signs, you kind of perform your physical exam, you get the history, and then you try to get your diagnosis, so kind of what's causing these vital sign changes, and then you do your treatment. So, you know, it's not enough to sort of say, oh, antibiotics won't work. Well, for what? You know, what is the diagnosis and what led to that diagnosis? So in this case, I'm saying that preach always when necessary, use words as a sort of overall church retention and recruitment strategy doesn't seem to be working. Let's work backwards. So I think the vital signs, and again, there's lots of ways you could think about this, but if, you know, Christ told us in John 6 that unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you. You know, again, we can splice exactly what that means, and that obviously the God offers mercy to everyone and so forth. But the idea is, for sure, we it seems like Christ wants people to receive the Eucharist, to be part of his body, unless, you know, you believe in it. Anyways, that he wants people to believe in him, right? Yeah. All right, so that's sort of like the overall, if our goal is that, that's basically health. That's one vital sign anyways. Obviously, our vital signs are very poor. So let's looking at an exam, some of the stats that you guys know, but for every convert to Catholicism, more than six are leaving it. So that both tells us that we're doing poorly on recruitment and in retention. P.S., that number is worse than every other religious group per the Pew study back in 2015, such that now 50% of young Americans, basically millennials, who were raised Catholic are no longer Catholic, just so sad. And the numbers are worse for the young. We know that over 8 million people are estimated to leave the Catholic Church in the next 10 to 20 years, as per the DMI. So just thinking, you know, that's 8 million people. That's someone's son and someone's grandson, someone's wife, et cetera. So that's just like the overall numbers of who's there. So that's the one vital sign. And then the second vital sign within it is sort of, and then who's actually participating. And we know those numbers. And here in New England, it's seen in empty parishes left and right. But then only 24% or so of Catholics go to mass on a given Sunday. And it's much worse among the youth. So, and then if you look internationally, and I've, you know, done some of these medical missions, but it's just as bad, you know, large numbers of Catholics in Central and South America are no longer Catholic. They're something else, Mormon, evangelical, and so forth. Basically, I think everywhere but Africa, our numbers are doing like really, really poorly. We're basically hemorrhaging members, and those who are staying aren't sort of receiving that bread that Christ offers. So that's sort of the vital signs that we know are bad. And honestly, I kind of wish that every parish meeting, every whatever, started with, okay, that's what we're up against. This is, you know, and Jesus wept. Okay. And not that we, so anyways, and then, so what's the diagnosis? And, it's not a mystery, with all respect to that bishop. To me, it seems pretty clearly, you know, I'm not a marketing guy, but, that, and, you know, if you look at other, religions who are doing much better, who's both their number of members who identify as such on surveys, as well as those who identify as going to church, you know, with some frequency, or, you know, or a synagogue or a mosque or so forth, are doing much better. We can kind of take a clue of what they're doing, what we're not doing. But basically, right, it's a recruitment strategy on one hand, retention strategy on the other. So maybe talking about the retention strategy, you know, and that's what you guys and other groups are doing. But, you know, the reality is that most parents sort of think, well, if I bring my kids to the, you know, to First Communion class, to confirmation class, and then sort of hope that magically this is going to work so that when they go off to college, that they're going to be, you know, sort of protected against the 5,000 onslaughts against their faith. So basically, we're not forming very well. One thing in that I just a quote from Brandon Vaught's book. Brandon Vaught, I think, has done, you know, great work in this, but his book Return, you know, to how do your help your child come back to the church, or the subtitle, that he quotes a parent as saying, one of my daughters went off to college and was given a pamphlet explaining 10 reasons the Catholic Church is wrong. She read it and left the church forever. I mean, goodness. And that was it.
Yeah, right. That child.
But that's,
okay, so
but that makes sense to me, and I mentioned this, and it was funny. A Benedictine abbot came because I gave a talk kind of about this topic, and he basically, and I mentioned the Muslim pamphlets from my own life, and he basically said, you know what, I became Muslim for several years because of the pamphlets. So, you know, anyways, I can just sort of finish my thing briefly, but in brief, the diagnosis is we're not doing a good job of retention or recruitment. We're basically not recruiting. We're just hoping that a good example suffices. Again, plenty of data that, you know, if they surveyed Catholics of all religious groups were the least likely to be even, you know, if you sort of asked you, it was a Pew study that if you encounter someone who disagrees about your religion, what should you do? And only 2% basically said you should try to evangelize. Almost everyone said agree to disagree or avoid discussing it.
Oh, wow. That's a Pew study?
So it's,
I haven't seen that one.
So 2014. Well, if I get to, so 67% said agree to disagree, 27% said avoid discussing, and only 2% of Catholics. Again, that's the lowest of every group.
Sure.
So the way I like to think of it, this is a maybe a fun metaphor, but if anyone who likes beer out there, but Trappist Chimay Ale is like, you know, arguably one of the best beers, and it's made by Trappist, so that's nice too. It's like the Catholic Church is offering Trappist Chimay Ale, just like the beer of beers, this wonderful, exquisite, wonderful thing, right? We've got the sacraments, we've got the saints, we've got Mozart, we've got Michelangelo, et cetera, all these beautiful things. But basically, we don't market at all. We don't talk about it. And in fact, if we put up a billboard, it'd say Trappist Chimay Ale. Actually, it's pretty expensive. So if you want to try the other beers, that's okay. And then meanwhile, the other beers, you know, pick whatever it is, are saying, oh, by the way, Trappist is made by pedophiles. And, you know, they suppress women and so forth. So this sort of like non-existent or anti-marketing strategy.
Right.
You know, it's like the idea. And honestly, this is what I thought my whole life, that, you know, if I'm a good guy, somebody's going to come up to me and say, wow, why are you such a good guy? And then I'm going to pull like a rabbit out of my hat, some, you know, magical two sentence, you know, proof of, well, because I love Jesus and he's the reason. And they'll say, really? Wow. Right. I want to be Christian too. And it's just not how it works. And, no. and so we imagine that basically, and, you know, not preaching that we're going to have any impact. So, that's sort of the vital signs and the diagnosis.
Give us the treatment. You're the doctor. We need a treatment for all this.
Yeah. So I think, again, look a little bit at other religious groups that are doing better than us. And, you know, not that we need to restructure things, but, you know, for example, our Mormon brothers and sisters, their Sunday school lasts all day. You know, they're in there basically eating and drinking the Book of Mormon all day, all in community together. Their retention is very good. Oh, P.S., they're required to do 2 years of missionary work somewhere. oftentimes in a Catholic country where the Catholics aren't putting up any sort of a defense, right? So, and if you go to Salt Lake City and have a long layover, what I've heard, I've not experienced this, is that there may be Mormons in the airport who will offer to drive you to their, you know, essentially their Vatican, give you a tour, and afterward they hand you a Book of Mormon, and the back is a photo of a family that is praying specifically for you. You know, that's a retention and a recruitment strategy. I think of Muslims, for example, they're required to go on a Hajj pilgrimage. That, I mean, you can imagine if every Catholic was required to go to St. Peter's or required to go to Jerusalem. You know, the prayers that are required, not to speak specifically in Islam about, let's just say, relatively strong pressures for people not to leave the faith. And, you know, certainly in some Muslim countries, if you look at the Pact of Umar in the 7th century and onwards, you know, pressures to come within. But even outside of those pressures, there's a strong community, there's sort of required prayers, and there's a very active evangelism. I can't tell you the number of places, including during the Via Crucis in Jerusalem, there's a man out there handing pamphlets out to the Christian pilgrims. You know, right across from the Holy Sepulchre, the holiest site in all of Christianity, there's basically a big banner in the mosque essentially saying, you know, I'm Allah and I don't have a son. You know, basically, anti-Christian propaganda, if you'll say
right,
that.
Right.
So we need to be a little less apologizing and more apologetic. You know, you guys are yeah. That's right. What you guys do. So, you know, I know, again, I'm not an expert in this, but some things that come to mind for me are, you know, I mentioned a few examples of pamphlets. So I think of myself, and you know, it's hard, you know, and I've got little kids and, you know, I have strong friendships and hanging out and going to the pub or whatever. So it's hard for me to sort of have some of those conversations, but you know, what's not that hard for me to do? I've talked to a couple of pastors in the area and we've got our little kiosks and I filled them up with pamphlets, 10 reasons to be Catholic and 10 answers to common objections. And, you know, why does the church teach X, Y, and Z? Because even if 0.1% of those pamphlets reach someone and help them come back, or otherwise, you know, kind of, it's the moment of the logos, the divine logos, reaching them through these logoi, the written words. And so rather than just kind of have a good, right, because I can at least point to a few anecdotes of people, of this Benedictine abbot who formerly was Muslim, because in myself, a well-educated, spent who knows how much on really good high school education. So I think pamphlets is something I wish that everyone in their parish could have pamphlets. It used to be CDs, but now nobody does CD players anymore. But whatever the equivalent thereof, of something that someone can take home with them, you can share with a friend. Book, even better. Obviously, you guys with Catholic Answers Press with the Trent Horn book, Why Be Catholic? What a great book. You know, it's not very big. It's not very expensive. So something like that, maybe offer with a friend. Hey, look, what's one book that you want me to read? And then you read this book and let's discuss, you know? So I think, and it just as a maybe an exclamation point on that, the more touristy the church, the more I feel like this would be helpful. 10 million people visit St. Peter's Basilica every year. And how many walk in and walk out and take their pictures and like have the same preconceptions about the Catholic Church they had before?
Right.
And there's no table, ask a priest. There's no, I've been in Baha'i. The Baha'i faith is one is seen as very tolerant and, you know, sort of more Eastern in this way. I remember going to the Baha'i temple in Delhi, India. Lovely, lovely building. And, you know, that's fine. I didn't have to pay anything. So when I came in and they shut the door and basically say, sit down and we're going to kind of preach to you about Baha'ism for a while, I didn't object. All right, that's your prerogative. I'm in your building. But here we are, like, you know, ashamed of talking about religion, you know, or even preaching within our own building. So I'd say we already have like the marketing structure. We're just not, you know, doing anything within it. So I'd say pamphlets, books. For myself, the one moment or whatever was a couple years ago, again, kind of getting fired up by Bishop Barron and realizing, and I think also reading the book, Brandon Vaught's Return, was a very helpful thing. That's another book. If every parish could have 100 copies in the back, I think even
that's
if only one helps someone.
I've read his book, What to Say and How to Say It. And yeah. But I have not read Return. So thank you for that recommendation.
And there's, And there's overlap, but you know, a lot of what I'm talking about here, which is sort of, all right, what's the problem? What can you physically, like how to actually, right? Because we're not trained. Our evangelical, our Mormon, our Muslim brothers and sisters from a very early age, they're trained to have these conversations and they don't feel awkward standing there handing out pamphlets. You know, we like get flabbergasted by this. So I think, you know, as it doesn't seem like training is likely to happen in your parish, although that'd be a great thing, read a book or, you know, any number of, you know, Word on Fire Institute, other things that people could do. But what kind of got me fired up with it, I did social media posts. So for Lent, a couple Lents ago, I basically sort of swallowed my fear and sort of said, you know what, every day of Lent, I'm going to write basically a post. So 40 reasons that I'm Catholic and answers to objections. And pretty public. I mean, I've got a lot of Facebook friends, and you know, God be praised. One of the basically the first time in my life, one of my friends who had been at Oxford with me, basically that was the start. So she converted. Her husband, who's a sort of big time lawyer, converted. Their daughter converted. Loves Mama Mary. They, you know, daily communicants as are able to. So, but it was only basically from stepping outside my awkward, like, oh, this is kind of posting about religion on Facebook. But it worked, you know, it reached somebody. So wow. I think social media can be a powerful thing. And there's just so much, I'd say, you know, you mentioned the last 10, 15 years, I think we're coming to a realization that I'm sorry, but with all due respect, the old boomer approach isn't working. And we can look at the data and clearly we failed to, as far as 8 million, you know, whatever number you want to use. And so we need some sort of fresh approach. So, you know, there's other ones, maybe start a book club and read books that could start nice conversations in that way. Maybe you invite someone to a retreat with you. How many people have come to the faith or come more deeply into their faith because of a Corcio retreat or some other retreat like that? My own wife, you know, kind of rediscovered Christ through a, you know, basically when a parish priest is like, we're starting a youth group and come on the retreat. And like, that's kind of what did it for her.
Wow.
So and I'd say maybe, you know, most importantly, twofold. One is, I mean, and this goes to the retention bit, but you know, we need to evangelize our children, our families, you know, first and foremost. So if you're more worried about, you know, the kids' soccer games than you are about church and catechizing and realizing that they need armor when they go out there because they're going to get pelted with arrows, then you have your priorities wrong. So first and foremost, you know, it's our responsibility with God's grace, cooperating with Him. We're not Pelagians, but to, you know, to try to get ourselves and our family to heaven. My spouse is my, you know, sort of number one priority. But I'd say as a corollary to that and talking about this evangelization, you know, I'm a nerd. I'm an academic. I like to write. I like pamphlets, that sort of thing. But, you know, I think the more normal, whatever approach would be one-to-one friendships. And again, I think Brandon Vaught's, both the books you mentioned, and there's others, but, you know, given examples of how to bring it up, you know, and there's one, I think it may be his evangelist who basically says, if I had an hour with a non-Christian, I'd listen for 55 minutes, then speak for the last five. That's counterintuitive. You know, I think if I'm going to try to quote convert someone or be an instrument of conversion, I need to talk. No, like we need to learn better strategies, which is to listen, to hear where they're coming from. Because you might think, oh, this person's not Christian because of whatever, and it might be a totally different issue. So listening, what's your experience of faith? And was it ever important to you? Or, you know, have you heard proofs of God's existence? What's the best one? Why does it not convince you? Whatever it might be. But you know, starting with a friendship, starting with that philia, and then, you know, letting this grow out of it. But the point is like actually starting that somewhat awkward at first conversation.
Right. But there are people that are doing, like you mentioned Brendan Vaught, you mentioned Bishop Barron. I can think of all the folks at St. Paul Street Evangelization who have wonderful training materials. Yep. You can come here to Catholic Answers. You can go to the Augustine Institute. There are people who are doing, Father Spitzer, another one, EWTN. Oh, yeah. The materials are beginning to be developed to help people go from I take profound offense that you blamed any of this on the boomers. I mean, just stop. But to move from what you might label a boomer approach to a, an, an evangelical Catholicism, not in the shallow sense of evangelical, but in the deep sense of it, that we have that beer, we have the bread, we've got to get it to people. I have to say, Dr. Hine, it's one of the easiest interviews I've ever done, and I think it's because there's two things that we love here: people who are fired up for the faith, but also have content that can help people in sharing the faith. And you gave us both of those today. I'm very, very grateful for that. Thank you for doing the interview with us.
And absolutely. And again, thank you for all you're doing. Thank you for mentioning all those resources. And maybe I can just close and just remind everyone, you know, this is hard and it takes guts. But in the end of the day, we've got the 10 talents and we can't bury it in the dirt. So you look at the early church and look what they went through and look what many of the best evangelists went through. And obviously be prudent. You know, you heard my disclaimer at the get-go. There's certain issues that I don't think we need to go waving in people's faces. But there's just so much treasure. There's so much in the Trappist beer that's so good, the Mozart, the Michelangelo, and the Flannery O'Connor, and so forth, that it's not something to be ashamed of. And yeah, it's awkward, and it inspires a little bit of fear. But anxiety is not from God. The evil one would love if we all just shut up and try to be nice. So, we just pray for the grace to be courageous.
Thank you so much. Our guest has been Dr. Tommy Hine, also the Gregory House of his generation. But I just feel like you've done us such a great service, and I'm very grateful. I hope we'll get to talk with you again. And God bless you on your journey towards ordination in the fall.
Thank you so much. Pray for us.
And thank you to our listeners. We appreciate that you take the time. If you've got something you'd like to say about this episode, maybe you've got an idea for a future episode, you can always get in touch with us. focus@catholic.com is our website. Our email address, focus@catholic.com. If you'd like to help us grow the podcast, you can do that by giving us the 5 stars and a few nice words wherever you listen to the podcast. You can support us financially, help us keep the lights on, get microphones working by going to givecatholic.com. Givecatholic.com. That does it for us. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.